Session number 10880, Alec Pugh, Reel 1.
Could you tell me where you were born and about your family, please?
Birmingham, Aston, Birmingham. And there were eight in family, six brothers and two girls.
What did your father do for a living?
He was a foreman in the special moulding shop at Dunlop Rubber Company.
And were you educated in Birmingham?
Yes, at Burlington Street School, Aston, and at Ryland Road School, Erdington.
What did you do when you left school?
Apprentice in a garage in Birmingham.
So how did you come to join the army?
Well, I decided that life was too monotonous to go on riding on a tram car up and down to the centre of Birmingham all my life. And I'd already had three brothers in the army and my father, and liked what they told me about it.
Was it easy to get in?
No, not at first. I went into the recruiting office and the recruiting sergeant asked me what I required, and I said to join the army. He asked me how old I was and I said 16. And he said, go walk round the block and come back when you're 18. So I walked round James Watt Street in Birmingham, went back in. He asked me what I wanted. I said, join the army. He said, how old are you? I said, 18. He said, sit down and we'll fill for me. And that's precisely what happened.
So you were a recruit to the Royal Warwicks?
To the Royal Warwickshire, yeah.
Can you tell me about your basic training, what it was like?
Thoroughly enjoyed it. Reported to Budbrook Barracks, Warwick, I suppose about a fortnight after I'd enlisted. And basic training in those days lasted round about 5 months.
Why did you enjoy it so much?
The exercise, open air, being out in the country, new company, and feeling I was a man. Since I was on man service, not boy service.
Were you treated harshly by the NCOs?
Strict discipline, but fair. No bullying or being awkward. There was the usual old soldier's business, you know. Anyone here know anything about bicycles? And someone would say yes, and the sergeant would say, well, mine is downstairs, go and clean it. But otherwise, I must say that the sergeant instructors and the corporals, in most cases, set an example as to how one should behave and conduct themselves and also turn out of dress.
So you had no complaints about how you were treated?
None whatsoever.
Were there any of the recruits who couldn't take the basic training?
No, I think they were all up to taking it, but we lost some by the wayside by way of criminal procedures because they were burglars or something like that, or had deserted from other regiments and rejoined into the Royal Warwicks, which in those days apparently was a commonplace thing.
This was 1937 when you were doing this basic training.
That's right.
Did you feel that a war was on the way then?
No. No.
Would it have made any difference to you joining up if you had?
No. Probably would have expedited my decision.
Why?
because I'm rather a nationalist at heart, and still am. And in those days, was proud of Britain, and to a certain extent, still am.
Do you remember the Munich crisis
of
1938 what you were doing then?
Yes, was at Aldershot then.
What happened?
Well, just there was a lot of activity regarding receiving of new vehicles, and and changing of equipment, because we were changing from the old 1914-18 style of equipment to the Bren equipment, you see, and Bren guns, because they were just coming in, having got rid of Lewis guns and as such. And of course, this was speeded up a little. But really, otherwise a newspaper talk, we wasn't concerned, or it didn't affect us a lot. I don't think anyone at that time woke up to the fact that there was a war imminent. We just accepted life as it went along.
What about when war was actually announced by Chamberlain in September 39?
Well, the lead up, we were on army manoeuvres at the a fortnight prior to the war starting, around the Newbury area. And rather comical, really, because we were out in Bren, you know, the Bren carriers, the trackmen, and a Dodar come up and said, "Get back to camp. We're all going back to barracks. You're all going to Poland." And one of the crew in my vehicle, who was a bit dim, said, "Gets the map out, the local map, like, where's Poland then?" Until someone enlightened him where it was. He thought it was a local village around Newbury. And then we returned to Aldershot, to Ramillies Barracks. And we started then to receive vehicles which had been requisitioned and had to be repainted and brought up to scratch. Rainbow paint wagons and Cogginses coal carts and various types of motorcycles. And also to check over weapons, clean grenades. And then on the Sunday morning, normally on Sunday mornings when you were in barracks, it was a church parade, but that Sunday morning there wasn't one. And we all assembled in the canteen, the naffy, I suppose they call it now, and listened to the announcement. There was not a general cheering as went on, similar to the First World War. There's one or two made remarks like "about time" and all the rest of it. But in general, it was accepted that we were going to war and it wasn't going to be pleasant. And then from then on, we started to clean grenades, load Bren gun magazines and in general prepared and receive reinforcements. By this time, we had received a lot of reinforcements who were they had put bell tents onto the barrack square, and these reinforcements, nearly all reservists who had already served the time in the forces, were placed into the bell tents and allocated to companies, of which Charlie Daly was one of them. He went to A Company. He had been originally a drummer. And from then on, it was a series of parades to see that we got all the kit, receiving special reservists, such as sergeant, bootmakers and repairers, ordnance. At those days, there was no remis, so your motor mechanics are all in the ordnance corps, and armourers and etc. And our vehicle mechanics, we got allocated, in actual fact, came from Preston and had all been in the post office repair garages there. So they came as a team. A sergeant, who was a foreman, I understand, there, and there was a lance corporal and a couple of mechanics.
How did you feel in 1939 that the British Army measured up to the German Army? Did you ever reflect on that?
Well, no, because we'd never met up or studied the modern German Army. We had no idea of numbers involved, such as armour or the quality of armour. Really, I think the British Army, the British soldier, and indeed the generals also, were living in a bit of a backwater regarding world military forces, etc., at that time. Because when the fighting did start, it was obviously that we were outclassed by materials and training, not by quality of men. I mean, as a man, we felt ourselves equal, if not better, than the German soldier.
But when the Poles were overwhelmed by the German army pretty quickly, did that make an impression?
No, because we was that busy getting ready to go abroad. As far as we're concerned, it was another country had gone, like Czechoslovakia had gone. It was that far away. I mean, don't forget that even France was a long way away in those days.
So you were telling me about preparing to go abroad.
Mm.
How did the actual move to France come, as far as you and your unit were concerned?
Well, the rifle companies, they went, I understand, from Southampton to Cherbourg. But the transport and carrier platoon, we drove to Newport in Wales and was loaded onto, I think, a ship called the Ben McCree. At Alexander Docks, Newport. We camped for one or two nights, I can't recall which now, in Tredegar Park at Newport while our vehicles were being loaded. And I must say that the people of Newport was most kind and looked after us very well when we went out in the evenings, you know. Provided suppers or drink free or pictures to the cinema free. Anyway, we sailed from Newport to Nantes on the Loire, to Nantes in France on the Loire, where our vehicles were unloaded. And we went to stay at a chateau, I suppose it would be, as far as I can recall, about 20 miles from Nantes, a place called Sablon. S-A-B-L-O-N, I think. I'll give you the names. I've got them written out somewhere. And from there, we then made our way to northern France in the area of the Franco-Belgian border, to a place called Achille-les-Petites.
How do you spell it?
Now let me think. A-C-H-I-E-T and L-E, Petite, as in French.
What kind of a place was it? A mining village or what?
No, it was a very tiny village. It was agricultural. And remarkably, our CO, and the second, or was it? It was the second in command and another officer had been there in the front line in the First World War, when the front line ran through the village.
What was the nearest big place?
Orcies. O-R-C-I-E-S. And the nearest large city was Lille, or Douai.
So you met up with your rifle companies there?
Not really, no. Because we were then being tactically deployed as rifle companies forward and then echelons, you see. A and B echelons. And we were only there a short while, and then we moved forward with the rifle companies into their border positions at Rummages on the Belgian border. While headquarter company plus the carrier platoon and the drums who acted as crews to the carrier platoon and certain elements of the motor transport were all in Marchiennes, which was about 6 or 7 miles beyond the border from Rummages.
So there you were preparing a line, were you?
We started to dig anti-tank trenches and building pillboxes, concrete pillboxes, to overlook the anti-tank trenches. And this went on all through the winter.
And did the carrier platoon have to do that work too?
Oh, yes. Mm. In the winter, the beginning of winter, you see, the weather was that severe you couldn't move about. It was the worst winter, according to the locals, that they endured in living memory. And it was a terrible winter. And, there was trouble with, you couldn't drive the track vehicles because at that time the roads were cobbles. And with a sheeting of ice on, all he done was slid off the cobble onto the soft shoulders or onto the earth, you see, or into the ditch. And except for elements of training and digging, things were rather quiet and at a standstill. People were sorting themselves out and getting settled in. Not knowing what to expect, of course. And things were arranged like shower baths at lawns at the coal mines there. And which meant that was more or less a day out of it because it all had to be loaded into trucks, taken down and driven back again. And otherwise, it's days just happened to be filled in by odd bits of training or fatigues or preparing wiring. So a lot of wiring went on. Carrier platoon, the drivers were obviously carrying out maintenance and the drums, the crews, were practicing brain gun training, etc., and 2-inch mortar training. Not that we'd got much ammunition for those. Until, of course, in March, yes, March, we went up to have our initiation of fire and was at a place called Bizing, which was about 5 miles in front of the Maginot Line in the at the Saar Valley.
How did the local French people receive you?
Very well, very well. In fact, I was in contact with people at Marchiennes right up until 1960. And was always welcome there. And so was I.
Did you ever come across hostility from French civilians?
Not really, no, no.
Did you see anything of the French army?
Oh, yes, yeah.
What impression did they make on you?
A mixed impression, really. Because the people who was garrisoned in the Maginot Line, you never saw much of those at all. The ordinary French army, the first impression I got when we landed at Nantes was that they were about 30 years out of date, because they were, their reservists had these sky blue uniforms, which were from before the First World War. And they had these old large rifles with a long, thin triangular bayonet on, which was a relic from pre-First War days. And we did find out afterwards that although they got these weapons, quite a lot hadn't got any ammunition that would fit them. But they were cordial to us and helpful, but I don't think the heart was in soldiering or war. I think they were still suffering the lashback from the First World War.
What impression did the Maginot Line make on you?
It looked good from what little knowledge we had of fortifications.
Were you invited to go around it?
Yes, but not only in small areas, very limited areas. When we went to our positions, we went through the fortifications and the defences, such as the anti-tank defences, which were effective. They were comprised of like huge, as I remember them, like huge curved railway lines, concreted into the ground and quite wide, I suppose, about 20 yards across in one long ribbon across the country. And these were in turn covered by heavy guns operated from the Maginot Line.
Were you aware of the extent of the Maginot Line, that it finished at two neutral countries either end?
Not at that time, no. No. And it was only afterwards that we learned that it was the Belgian government who refused to allow the French to extend it to the coast. Otherwise, there may have been a different story to tell.
You said that you went to this place called Bizinge.
Yes, Bizing, Bizing.
What exactly did you do there?
Well, the rifle companies took over part of the line, and we was positioned just behind the rifle companies as headquarters troops would be, so it was a sort of second line. And one of the outstanding memories is the French had artillery gun, field guns, 75 millimeter ones, which were horse drawn by a team of four or six horses, and we dubbed them the Gypsy Artillery, because every now and again they would come galloping up with a flourish, unlimber the guns, set them up, and fire five or six rounds at the Germans. Relimber and gallop away and leave us to take anything by way of mortars or artillery that was coming back in reply. And I must say, at that age and at that stage, we wasn't unduly worried about the return fire.
So, do you remember that your Royal Warwick's units got into action with the Germans, apart from the French firing their artillery?
Oh, yes. Crikey, what company was it? I've got it upstairs somewhere. In actual fact, there was quite a there was it was heavy patrolling, fighting patrol work between the British and the German lines, and much like the Germans were patrolling between our lines. And I don't know whether it was hearsay or rumour, but apparently any Germans, their final test as cadets to be commissioned was to take a patrol across No Man's Land. And there was a lot of German patrolling going on at that time. And there was a couple of clashes, and as a result of one clash, there was... Out of two clashes, that's right. One officer got the MC. Two officers got the MC, but on different engagements. And a sergeant got the MM, and a private soldier got the MM.
But your carry platoon people weren't involved?
No, we were actually in the village part where the rifle companies was on the woods and the forward slopes, really, of the Saar Valley.
Did you know whether you were on German territory or French territory?
Oh, we were on German. Because we found... We were in an old post office and we found some stamps which were the German with little Z on, really, and also the German pfennigs and currency marked on them. But it was definitely German territory, that one.
Did you come across local civilians there?
No, they were all evacuated out of it. I should imagine they were evacuated back behind, because the line run up the Saar Valley through Strasbourg, which was split in two with the French on one half and the German line on the other. And I think they would have been, any French civilians would have been evacuated to Alsace, and the Germans would have been cleared out behind Strasbourg.
Now, can we go on to May the 10th, when the Germans attacked? And can you tell me what you remember of that day?
Yes. I suppose we'd been back from the Saar about a month then. And we were in Le Forêt. And word came through that the Germans had invaded the Low Countries, and this was heralded by intense air activity over us, over Le Forêt and the Belgian border, and the bombing of Douai, which was not too far distant. And once again, we started... Brain guns. We were in houses by platoons, with civilians either side, and Bren guns are set up at the bottom of the garden for anti-aircraft. And then we once again started to check all ammunition, load vehicles, clean grenades, and prepare ourselves to move forward into Belgium. But this didn't happen for a few days, but when we did